When I first wrote In League with a UFO, I did not want to be associated with the UFO phenomena and was not sure how to put the information out without admitting my personal experiences. So I put the manuscript away for 2 years before revisiting it again and publishing the manuscript. Unbeknownst to me at the time was that my book would come out in print 2 weeks before the 50th anniversary of the Roswell crash. My publisher informed me of that fact and suggested that I should take advantage of the crowds that would converge in Roswell, New Mexico on July of 1997, to sell my books. I declined and my book remained for the most part unknown for nearly 10 years after publication. A few books were purchased and in the second year one was invited to a filming of a documentary concerning UFOs and again I declined publicity for the book. I did however do a couple of radio shows which netted me a few book sales. How I came to have this information is as strange as the information itself. I was a home builder at the time with no desire to write and little if any writing ability to boot. I received a call one day and was invited to have lunch by an individual I did not know. I often met with clients and suppliers who I did business with and didn't give it much thought when I accepted the invitation. I met with this fellow at an upscale restaurant and we never once talked about construction, which should have been odd, but for some reason it was not. During our conversation he handed me some papers that he took from his briefcase and showed them to me. I can't to this day recall what we talked about or what was on those papers, but not long after that day I began to write down the material that is now in this book. Headline: UFO Crash. The year was 1947. The place Roswell, New Mexico. On July 2nd, of that year, reports of a bright disc streaming across the sky were made by some of the townspeople to the local authorities. The unidentified flying object, UFO, fell from the sky and crashed approximately 75 miles northwest of town that day. A rancher or farmer that heard the crash and had thought that an airplane had fallen into a field a short distance from the house he was living in, investigated. What he found at the scene was nothing he could relate to and it certainly didn't look to him like it was from this world. He was so mystified about what he saw that he didn't report it until 5 days later, on July the 7th when he went into town for some other business. He told some friends that the craft was made of a strange material that had no weight to it, yet seemed to have incredible strength. Years later some of the material found at the crash site was equated to looking like aluminium foil. Coincidentally, aluminium foil was invented that year, 1947. However, aluminium foil is easily damaged and destroyed, unlike the material from the alien ship. Once the news spread about the rancher's claim of finding a UFO, the excitement mixed with apprehension, thoughts of an alien invasion, spread throughout the town like a brush fire. It was not long after the rancher showed the crash site to one of the military officers that the rancher suddenly became silent on the topic and spoke no more about it. He refused to discuss what he had found with the media or his friends. Nevertheless, the news was out and it quickly traveled around the country and the world as the press corps inundated that small New Mexico town. Ironically, much of what is known all about the UFO crash was released to the media by a public relations officer from the Army, Air Force, the same people that later denied it. A military officer told the press that a flying disc had crashed and that the Army, Air Force did recover it. In 1947 the Army and the Air Force was one branch. From that statement, people from all over the world wanted to know more. Some of the talk around town focused on topics that questioned the very nature of man's existence. What if we are not alone in the universe? Was this crash proof that other life forms did exist? And if so, what a scary thought that was. Those were some of the concerns talked about. Orson Welles' War of the Worlds of a few years earlier, in 1938, was still on the minds of many of the town folks. That alleged alien crash implied that a real alien invasion could be imminent. There was anxiety mixed in with the excitement. Those were dire implications to that possibility and the government soon realized it was not in a position to answer the queries and concerns coming at them by the potentially panic-provoking reporters. not knowing what the army had in its possession and at the same time attempting to halt what had turned into a media circus of paranoia. The military retracted its earlier statement about a flying disc and blamed the misunderstanding to a misinformed lower-ranking officer. The military's new report simply stated that a new kind of weather balloon that was being tested in the nearby military base is all that was recovered from the now-famous Roswell crash. The crash of a weather balloon was much easier to swallow than aliens from space and a lot less frightening for the public at large. Few people doubted the military's explanations and welcomed them, and the public quickly forgot the whole matter. Headline: Cover-up. The top brass in the military was unable to give the President of the United States any details of what they had in their possession, other than it did appear to be extraterrestrial and not of this world. That was enough information for the President to make the decision to keep the whole affair a secret until further notice. A secret committee was formed with the sole intention of studying the alien craft. It was put under the jurisdiction of the Air Force and received its funding from them. The committee operated under the pretext of integrating new technologies to develop better maneuverability and faster flying military aircraft, top secret stuff. The facility is located near the Nevada-Arizona border and is popularly known as Area 51. It was one of the most hush-hush bases in the country until sometime in the 70s. That's when UFO buffs began mentioning it in their meetings, and the media started writing about it in newspapers and magazines. Information about UFOs came from a multitude of sources. From the average citizen that reported to the media that they had seen aircraft perform fantastic feats of maneuverability near military bases and at Area 51, and professionals that claimed what they saw defied all concepts of what military aircraft, or any aircraft, was capable of doing without breaking apart. Moving diagonally while traveling at a high rate of speed was one of their more bizarre instances reported. Other sources or leaks came from former military personnel who worked at certain bases and spoke under the condition that their names would not be used. Area 51 remains a top secret facility, but everyone knows its whereabouts. It now serves more as a decoy, keeping the public focused on that one place and away from other concealed operations across the country, according to a document. The military had in its possession a flying machine so advanced and mysterious that some of the scientists involved in the program speculated that it could only be from other dimensions, or that the alien ship was capable of traveling from one dimension to another as a means to traverse the vastness of our Milky Way galaxy. The craft was like a living organism, claimed a document in one of the secret files. When the ship was first recovered, there was a large hole on one side of it, presumably caused by an internal explosion. Perhaps a leaky antimatter type component of the craft was one theory. The explosion annihilated a large portion of the ship. The actual size of the alien craft was not found in the documents. Miraculously, 3 weeks after the craft was discovered, the ship completely healed, repaired itself. To say the least, it was a very mysterious event, since the craft was monitored 24 hours a day and no alien work crew materialized to perform the work. If aliens did repair the ship, they were either invisible or the aliens rendered the guards unconscious and implanted false memories into their minds. The scientists that monitored the craft reported that the healing occurred similar to a human flesh wound, which heals within a few days with the help of blood platelets from the human body. The skin or surface of the ship simply grew back over a period of 3 weeks. In reality, there is no similarity to the human immunology and that of the ship's own ability to heal. Had a human suffered an equivalent trauma, nothing would have grown back and the human would have died. At the end of the 3 weeks, there was no sign that the ship had been damaged, no scar, and the color match where the hull had been broken blended flawlessly with the undamaged part of the ship. The debris from the explosion covered several acres of land with material that had the appearance and consistency of aluminium foil, except that aluminium foil remains crumpled when crumpled. The alien material bounced back without a wrinkle. Because the craft repaired itself, the scientists investigating it were unable to determine the cause of the crash. But the size of the hole led them to believe that it had to be an internal explosion and not the crash that caused the damage. The material the ship was made of was indestructible by human standards. After studying the material and its strength, they came to the conclusion that anything earthly could not harm the ship in any way, nor cause the slightest damage to it, including that of a lightning strike, one of the original theories on what caused the saucer to crash. Of the three aliens that were recovered from the craft when it was found, one was dead and two were alive. The three aliens were removed from the ship at the time of its recovery and taken to an undisclosed location. The secret committee in possession of the alien craft had no knowledge of the whereabouts of the aliens. And at that time were unconcerned. They had plenty on their plate with the alien ship and the mysterious cargo that was in it. Several months passed before the scientists felt comfortable working inside of the alien craft. Entering it was like walking into a time warp, all sense of reality vanished. Wristwatches did not operate inside the alien craft and neither did any of the five physical human senses. Things smelled differently or not at all while in the ship. Body odor lost its pungency, however, the food they brought into the ship gave off an offensive odor, as if it was rancid, making it inedible while in the ship. Perfume and cologne was undetectable until they stepped out of the ship and the nose once again picked up on the scent. From the experiments with food, the scientists determined that it was not permanently affected or altered in any way, and the food regained its natural smells and taste when it was taken out of the alien craft. The other senses, sight, hearing, and touch, changed for the better. If a scientist wore glasses, he needed to remove them to be able to see. It was the same with hearing. All sound was crystal clear regardless of previous hearing abilities of the scientists. Touch was sensitive to the point of being erotic. The ship simply felt good. However, the scientists were not accustomed to feeling optimally good and healthy, and it took time, most never did, before they became comfortable with the invigorating sensation inside the ship's environment. Unfortunately, if they spent long periods in the craft, coming out was the worst kind of jet lag. The scientists became irritable, groggy, drained, and achy and had to readjust to feeling lousy again. Ironically, that was the normal feeling of their bodies that they forgot about while in the ship. Although the senses were on high alert while in the ship, the description that was unanimous among those that entered the ship was that it was surreal. They had a dreamy state of mind, yet, they were energized and not at all sleepy while in the ship. On the flip side, much of that alertness turned into apprehension, and for some, nightmarish. The persistent feeling that something living, aliens, was present in the ship with them, behind them, around them, like wisps or shadows that never quite came into focus. It was unnerving for those that worked inside the craft. There was no doubt that they were not alone while in the ship. To compensate for the time distortion, the scientists posted two men outside the craft and had one of them enter the ship every few minutes, and announce the time to those inside. When the craft was first discovered, the scientists spent hours and sometimes days oblivious to the fact that even a single minute had passed. Working for long stretches of time without losing energy or focus was common, but it created problems for those with families. The interior of the craft was much larger than its physical exterior suggested. No one is sure that all the rooms and compartments on the ship have been discovered. Everyone who entered it came out with a different numbers. Even the same person comes out with a different count each time they leave the craft. Another problem they faced was leaving the ship with intelligible notes. Everything they wrote down ended up being a maze of half-written words and sentences that were void of any meaning once they exited the ship. The scientists attempted to take pictures of the instruments and other interior rooms of the ship, but were unsuccessful. When the film was developed, it was as if it had been exposed to light. So they tried different systems of shielding the camera from the unknown radiation. They enclosed the camera in various alloys, plastics and exotic cutting-edge ceramics in vain attempts to insulate the film. Nothing worked. There were scores of gadgets on the ship. Some have been taken out of the ship and experimented with, others even though they are portable could not be removed from the craft. An invisible force inside the craft kept the scientists from leaving the ship with certain alien items. No one ever figured out why, nor how to circumvent that force. Every alien gadget somehow knew what its purpose was. Unlike human gadgets like hammers, toasters, etc., which are static and only function correctly if at all with the help of a human, or an electrical outlet, alien objects appeared to have consciousness, were alive, and they performed duties independently and without any known power source like batteries, solar cells, or electrical cords, and operated indefinitely. The opening or doorway to the ship was another mystery. When a scientist approached the craft with the intention of entering it, an opening appeared instantly. If there was no intention by the scientist of entering the ship, nothing opened. The ship can be entered from any location, top, sides and from the bottom of the craft. Wherever a scientist approached the ship, that's where they entered. When an opening manifested, it led to the same central location, regardless of the point of entry. The craft was able to absorb several people into it at once. A feat that left many of the scientists spooked beyond comprehension. According to one testimony, if all the technicians who were analyzing the craft formed a circle around it and intended to enter it in mass, they all did. There are no doors, as we know and understand doors, only an opening that accommodates the size of the person or persons entering the ship. The ship appeared to work something like osmosis. The person desiring entry and standing next to the ship instantly found himself inside the ship. Yet, if there was no mental desire to enter or exit, the ship remained impregnable. No man-made machinery could break into the ship. Headline: Strange life forms inside the ship. Everything in the ship possessed unique personalities that were also capable, in the most bizarre ways, of conveying emotions to the scientists. The best description of these gadgets by the scientists was that they were like synthetic versions of insects and small animals. They lacked organic qualities in the respect that they didn't eat, drink, or eliminate, yet the gadgets didn't have static qualities of synthetic human-made materials. The alien gadgets squirmed, crawled, levitated, jumped, flew and walked. The size of the living gadgets ranged from a deer tick to a basketball. The majority of the items fitting in the palm of the average man's hand. The scientists treated some gadgets as delightful toys, and occasionally fought over them like children, impatiently waiting their turn to inspect, explore, and be entertained by the gadgets. However, some of the alien thingamajigs turned out to be monsters. Many of the items seemed to be metallic, sturdy and unbelievably strong, and at the same time malleable, like soft putty. The ambiguity of the strange substance that the gadgets were made of confounded the research teams. The consensus was that the material from which the ship and its contents consisted of made a mockery of human physics. Alien gadgets didn't function like human machinery with the use of gears, motors, wheels, wiring, or even our most state-of-the-art microelectronics like nanotechnology. Nor did the gadgets function physiologically, with bone, blood and muscle, or like the plant and marine life either. It appeared that every molecule of whatever these things were made of acted in unison in the same manner that water molecules join together to create ocean waves. There are no human means available to dissect the alien gadgets, they are impervious to our inferior technology to penetrate and analyze. The alien things didn't have seams or edges to pry open, no organs or flesh to probe, they couldn't be weighed nor their contents measured. They appeared to be cast from one solid piece with no parts, except that they were not solid, as we know solid to be. One analogy describing alien material was malleable and solid, but temperature had nothing to do with either state, as it does with earth metals, liquids, and gases. Alien gadgets transitioned to four physical stages, solid, malleable, liquid and gas, without external heat variation. Change happened at the discretion of the alien gadget and not the human handler. Attempts to study the items were further blunted when X-ray failed to penetrate the alien material. There is no human means to understand what made those gadgets work other than paranormally. Nothing connected with the craft aged, wore out, or became obsolete. Rather, the things in the ship and the ship itself appeared to improve over time. The gadgets also seemed to learn the habits of the handlers. An example: if a hammer were an alien gadget, all one needed to do was use it once, and from then on the hammer would repeat the action indefinitely, hitting the nail without the need to handle the hammer manually. The hammer would operate on its own, although someone had to hold the nail and pray that the hammer didn't miss. Alien technology, although perfect, is problematic when interfacing with inferior technology and understanding. The scientists discovered that controlling an alien item once it became activated was a dangerous proposition. Several accidents and fatalities due to human-alien interactions were mentioned in the reports. The recovered ship had three or more rooms equipped like futuristic surgical-looking rooms. The rooms were brighter and had the feel of a place where flesh meets the scalpel. It was believed by members of the team that many, if not all, of the gadgets on the ship were related to or performed medical functions. After suffering a few mishaps, loss of life and limb, from coming into contact with alien objects from experimenting on each other, the scientists decided to utilize cadavers instead of themselves in order to reduce pain, suffering, and death among its members. After many failed attempts to get the alien objects to function on cadavers, the alien things did not respond to dead flesh. The scientists began using live animals such as rats, rabbits, pigs, chickens, mice, cows, horses, toads, fish and other types of wildlife. Some alien instruments activated, woke up, when they came in contact with only certain animals. Cattle, horses and humans always triggered the alien gadgets to perform a freakish event. The alien things have no outward appearances or labeling that identified the functions associated with them. Scientists discovered what each item did mostly by accident. Deciphering what any one item was capable of. Doing or performing was impossible using the tried and true methods of deduction. The scientists had to stumble around, sometimes awkwardly and maybe foolishly, until a function or procedure presented itself. Discoveries during testing happened by placing the alien objects directly on the animals or in close proximity to the animals, and then a wait-and-see approach went into play. A response from the gadgets might take place instantly or it could take hours, and in some cases more than a day before the gadgets decided to do something. The subjects, animal or human, were not sedated during the experiments because that seemed to compromise the testing. In some cases, the alien things were fastened onto the subjects with straps, clamps, and tape or held in place by one of the technicians. Although holding the alien object had its own consequences for the experimenters because sometimes the alien object performed its thing on the person holding it, which was not a pretty picture, according to one memo. When dormant, the gadgets were usually spherical and had the appearance of black ball bearings, although there were other shapes and colors they reverted to while inert as well. Most of the items were smaller than a baseball and larger than a golf ball, but new gadgets appeared and disappeared regularly. The majority of the objects were black in color while dormant. Some were multicolored or translucent and had no color. Touching certain items sucked the heat from the fingertips, and in some instances caused a few scientists to lose parts of their fingers from frostbite or exotic alien radiation. At times the gadget's physical weight, referred to as obstinacy in the documents, was such that the scientists could not pick up or move the gadgets, even with the use of machines. At other times those same objects were lighter than air, and bobbed around the laboratory like helium balloons at a birthday party. During the experiments with the animals, they discovered that some instruments responded when they came within 1 inch from touching the animal. Other instruments needed to have full contact with the animal before activating. What was considered activation was when an alien object reacted in any number of ways, such as change color, change size or shape, or outright perform its function on that animal, for example, remove a specific body part, perform a biopsy, or any number of strange transactions that the scientists didn't understand. What these alien instruments did was unclear with the early experimenters. In some of the early notes that survived was written that the alien objects mutilated the animals by removing tissue and sometimes organs from them, for no apparent reason. The animals were healthy before the experiments and might have remained so had the scientists known how to reverse, or somehow communicate their desired outcome to the gadget. For instance, please put the bunny's head back on. Experimenting on humans was not taboo in the 1940s, and was practiced in many countries as well as in the United States, albeit covertly. But even before tests were begun on human guinea pigs, some scientists who fiddled with these aliens' tools unwittingly were maimed, and in a few instances, killed by the instruments. At the onset of the program, accidents did get recorded officially. But as the years went by and the program became increasingly shrouded in secrecy, information was shared unofficially, through the grapevine. It was forbidden to write certain things down. Nevertheless, some scientists secretly did. Information that made it to paper or other storage devices such as tape recorders and photography, was never meant for sharing with other scientists in the program, but was to be forwarded directly to the committee only. Therefore, how many scientists lost their lives from contact with the alien things no one will know. One of the first injuries recorded took place early in the program. It happened to a metallurgist. He was studying the bizarre behavior of exotic alien metal while it transfigured during a test. He and a colleague were monitoring a batch of alien gadgets that were assigned to them that morning. Scientists doing experiments with alien objects were located in a separate building from where the alien craft was stored. Divide and conquer was the theme. By putting distance between the craft and the alien objects, the scientists were hoping to eliminate any interference or potential influence that the craft might have on the gadgets. The scientists were concerned that the ship somehow remained in communication with its spawn. Another reason they experimented off the ship was that the craft was too strange a place to work inside of. Inside the ship was real-life Alice in Wonderland stuff. It was nearly impossible to get anything meaningful done while strange creatures jumped around and harassed the scientists working inside the ship. The metallurgist and a colleague had scattered the alien objects around a large table in his lab. They then released a rabbit in the midst of the objects to see if any of them would activate due to the presence of the animal. They observed and waited. They watched for the slightest responses from the objects as the rabbit moved around the table eating the lettuce. The lettuce was strategically placed around the table so that the rabbit would make maximum contact with all the items that were put out that day. The rabbit didn't seem bothered by the alien things. The rabbit was unaware that any one of the alien gadgets it brushed up against could snatch it up, skin and gut it, and have it fully cooked in less than a couple of minutes. The job had many hidden dangers, but the scientists did eat well. Knowing the hazards of mishandling the alien things, it was incomprehensible that scientists working with such volatile objects took the risks that they did. As the rabbit hopped about the table, the scientists noticed that one of the alien things changed color as the rabbit got near. Believing that the metal was about to change shape, the scientist wanted to hold the alien object in his hand to get a feel for what was taking place. The metal quivered, so he took it to his desk where the light was better. As he studied it under the light of his desk lamp, somehow his face made contact with the object. The thing activated and instantly scooped out his eyeball. It happened so quickly that he didn't have time to drop the object, which was still holding his eyeball securely in its scoop-like claw. His colleague, after seeing what had happened, thought that the alien thing was attacking his friend and summoned the guard that was posted outside the room in the hall. The guard reluctantly grabbed the instrument with the eye attached to it and slowly removed it from the injured scientist's hand. The scientist let go of it as he collapsed to the floor, dazed, as if he were hit by a baseball bat over the head. No blood spilled from the scientist's eye socket, but he was in severe pain and went into shock. His colleague was perplexed of what to do with the eyeball. He told the guard to remain with the injured man and took the eyeball along with the alien object, which was remained attached to it, and put them into the refrigerator in the lunchroom. They were unable to save the eye, even though it was not damaged in any way.